Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy, Pete Musto, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
For 185 years, Green Mountain College has been educating students in the small town of Pulteney, Vermont. The college announced last month it is closing at the end of the current school year. The announcement has left hundreds of students trying to decide where to go next. Green Mountain is a small, private, liberal arts college that has seen a 43% drop in the number of students studying there over the past 10 years. The Associated Press, or AP, notes that Green Mountain is going the way of some other small colleges and universities in the United States. These schools have struggled to continue operating during a general move toward career-centered training. They are also dealing with decreasing numbers of high school students, especially in the country's northeast, the area known as New England. Lauren Coy is an environmental studies major at Green Mountain. She told the AP she is very sad about the college's decision to close. "I mean, this community is so great, and I fell in love with the campus as soon as I came here, and the farm, and the goats, and everyone in town, too," she said. Coy added that she and her friends thought they had another year and a half together before they completed their studies and left the school. "Now it's only 4 months," she said.
To help protect students, Vermont state officials have been looking into increasing their oversight of private independent colleges. The plans have met resistance from college leaders who worry schools' financial problems could be made public before they are at serious risk of closing. In Massachusetts, at least 17 colleges have closed or joined with other schools over the past 6 years. Massachusetts education officials are moving forward with a plan to inspect the financial health of colleges every year and estimate their risk of closing. If the state decides a college might not finish the next academic year, it would be required to tell students and prepare a plan to help them gain admission to another school. The state moved to intervene after the sudden closure of Mount Ida College in Newton, Massachusetts. Mount Ida announced last April it would be closing just a few weeks later. The news shocked students. In Vermont, officials took notice when Burlington College closed in 2016 under the weight of debt from a land deal. The closing left no one in charge of Burlington's student records. Lawrence Capoli serves on Vermont's House Committee on Education. He said the state's Agency of Education had to take control of the records, which was costly. The next year, the state legislature had the Association of Vermont Independent Colleges set up an agreement with its member schools to house student records if a school closed. Last year, Vermont lawmakers considered creating rules for for any school being examined by its accrediting agency for financial reasons. Such schools would have been required to inform the state of the investigation and offer a plan for student records, setting money aside if necessary. That bill did not pass, but lawmakers say they hope to consider similar proposals this legislative term.
Catherine Webb heads Vermont's House Education Committee. She noted, with the recent news about Green Mountain College and concern about what's happening around New England, it does seem appropriate for us to continue to look at a response. The Massachusetts plan has led to criticism from some college administrators. Helen Drynan is president of Simmons University in Boston. She said the plan seems like an unnecessarily large reaction to the Mount Ida closure, which she described as one really bad incident. "It feels like a heavy step," argued Drynan. "Anybody caught in that net is going to get a lot of attention that may or may not be deserved, and that may or may not seal their fate. That just doesn't seem right." Carlos Santiago is head of the Massachusetts Department of Higher Education. He said he understands the concern from some schools and plans to work with them to finalize the state's inspection process. At least 64 four-year private, nonprofit colleges and universities around the country have closed or announced closures since 1995, while 12 others have opened. These numbers come from the National Association of Independent Colleges and Universities.
Moody's Investor Service said in December that its position on the U.S. higher education industry is negative. The reason? Limits on the growth of money schools earn from tuition payments. The U.S. Department of Education and college accreditors have their own processes to measure the finances of schools and place struggling schools under close watch. But officials in Massachusetts say the process has failed to raise warnings soon enough in the past. As of last December, more than 500 colleges and universities were being closely watched by the Education Department. The schools included Green Mountain College, but not Newbury College, in Brookline, Massachusetts. Newbury announced on December 14th it would close after this academic year. Green Mountain had just 428 undergraduate students signing up for its classes 6 months ago. The college explored possible partnerships and ways to increase money coming in before announcing its closure. A group of former students and parents is raising money to try to keep the school from closing, but many students are already making other plans. Green Mountain said it has agreements with some other colleges that will take in its students. One such school is Prescott College in Arizona. "Students knew that Green Mountain was in trouble," said Kyle Patterson of New Jersey. "So he made plans to attend Paul Smith's college in New York. I just felt bad for everyone else who didn't have a plan," he said. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Our world is home to thousands of different kinds of birds. No two bird species are the same.
Each one has its own unique qualities, like its feathers. Feathers keep a bird warm and dry. Feathers also help it to fly. And they can be very colorful, making a woodpecker with its bright red feathers stand out in the woods on a cold, wintry day. And people have been wearing bird feathers on hats for hundreds of years. But feathers were not just worn for decoration, to improve a person's appearance. Hundreds of years ago, it also meant something else. A feather could represent a person's standing, success, or even, in some cases, a kill. Feathers have made their way into many common English expressions. Today we talk about one, to have a feather in your cap. A feather in your cap is something you are really happy about. The feather gives you bragging rights, a chance to tell the world about your success. A feather in your cap also gives you an upper hand, meaning it puts you in a better position. For example, on social media, having a million followers on Twitter can be considered a feather in your cap. Getting a pay raise or winning an award can both be feathers in your cap. So it is something you can be proud of and something you can use in the future to get ahead. The Etymology Online website notes that the act of placing a feather in a hat or on your head has meant success in many cultures, apparently independently. As an example, the site uses the early English travel writer Richard Hansard and his 1599 description of Hungary.
It has been an ancient custom among them that none should wear a feather but he who had killed a Turk.
And some Native American tribes would give feathers to someone for a brave act. The saying, a feather in your cap, is widely used in conversation and in some songs. Many American children sing these words without even knowing what they mean. Let's listen to part of a well-known song called Yankee Doodle.
Yankee Doodle went to town riding on a pony. Stuck a feather in his cap and called it macaroni. Yankee Doodle, keep it up, Yankee Doodle dandy. Mind the music and the step and with the girls be handy.
This song dates back to the days of the American War of Independence. Some people say British soldiers sang it as a way of making fun of the opposing forces. Doodle was an 18th century British term for a stupid person, and macaroni meant a well-dressed person, someone who likes the finer things in life. So saying, stuck a feather in his cap and called it macaroni, meant that the colonists thought they could look good by simply placing feathers in their caps. By the way, we still use both doodle and macaroni today, except the meanings have changed completely. A doodle is a quickly made and simple artwork, and macaroni is a small noodle. One last note on this expression. The word cap can belong to anyone. In fact, you can use whatever descriptive words you need to explain who is wearing the cap. For example, winning an Oscar is a feather in a director's cap, and getting accepted to a great university would be a feather in any student's cap. Hopefully, speaking English is now a feather in your cap. And that brings us to the end of Another Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Disappointment is a feather in your cap. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On July 4th, 1863, a huge Confederate army surrendered at Vicksburg, Mississippi. Union forces had surrounded the city for 47 days. Food was gone. The situation was hopeless. The Confederate commander gave up. The terms of surrender were simple. The Confederate soldiers promised not to fight anymore. In return for this promise, they were released on parole and sent home to their families. Never had Union forces won such a victory. 30,000 Confederate soldiers were now out of the war. 60,000 guns and 170 cannon were now in Union hands. The Mississippi River was now under Union control. Larry West and Morris Joyce continue our story of the American Civil War.
The victory at Vicksburg went to General Ulysses Grant. He was named commander of all Union armies in the West. Then he was sent to Chattanooga, Tennessee. The Union army there had just been defeated in a battle along a little river called the Chickamauga. Now the Union soldiers were resting and reorganizing in Chattanooga. The Confederate line stretched halfway around the city. The Confederates had artillery on Lookout Mountain. They controlled every road into the city, except a rough one through the mountains. They had blocked the Tennessee River, above and below the city. And they had cut the railroad. The Confederate general said he would let hunger force the Union army to surrender.
Grant arrived in Chattanooga late in October. The city was full of hungry Union soldiers. They had been without supplies for almost a month. Grant wasted no time. He quickly sent troops to fight the Confederate force blocking the Tennessee River. He sent others to fight the Confederates blocking the road to the nearest Union supply center. Within 1 week, supply wagons were rolling into Chattanooga. Within a few weeks, the defeated Union army was ready to fight again.
General Grant sent his men against the middle and ends of the Confederate line at the same time. There were few Confederate soldiers at Lookout Mountain. That end of the line fell easily. The center of the line was along a low hill called Missionary Ridge. It held for a while. Then Union soldiers, acting without orders, forced their way to the top of the hill. The Confederate line broke. Southern soldiers threw down their guns and ran for their lives. The Confederate army withdrew south into the state of Georgia. Tennessee was completely in Union hands. The way was now open for the armies of the North to march into the heart of the Confederacy.
It was clear that the South could not win the war. Too many Confederate soldiers had fallen in battle. None were left to take their place. Supplies were very low. There was not enough food to eat, no shoes to wear, and little left to fight with. No one held any hope of getting supplies from outside the Confederacy. The South was circled by Union troops and warships. All seemed lost. Yet Confederate soldiers refused to stop fighting. They would not surrender. The war would not end until the Confederate armies were defeated by military force.
There was no question that the North had the military strength. Supplies were no problem. Factories were producing more than ever before. Manpower was no problem. Men continued to join the Union Army. Fewer than before, but still enough to make it a powerful force. The problem with the Union Army was its generals. Some were too careful. Some were unwilling to fight. Some did not know how to fight. The only general who seemed able to win victories was Ulysses Grant. That is why President Abraham Lincoln named Grant commander of all Union armies. Lincoln depended on him to end the Civil War.
Grant went east in March 1864, 5 months after the battle at Chattanooga. He decided to make his headquarters in the field, with the Army of the Potomac. He said he would not command from an office in Washington. But he went to the city to explain his plans to President Lincoln. Grant noted that, in the past, the separate Union armies had moved and fought independently. He said they were like a poorly trained team of horses. No two of them ever pulled at the same time in the same direction. Under his command, Grant said, the Union armies would pull together. They would hit the Confederates with so much strength in so many places that the rebels could not stop them. Grant said all the armies would attack at the same time.
Grant spent the month of April preparing for the big campaign. The main target, once again, was the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. The Army of the Potomac had 120,000 men. It would move against Richmond from the north. General Ben Butler had 50,000 men. He would move against Richmond from the east. General Franz Sigel would bring thousands more through the Shenandoah Valley to the northwest. These forces were three times the size of Robert E. Lee's army near Richmond. In the west, William Sherman had three armies with more than 100,000 men. His opponent, Joe Johnston, had just 60,000.
General Grant kept details of the campaign as secret as possible. Reporters asked President Lincoln when Grant would move. The president answered, "Ask General Grant." "General Grant will not tell us," said the reporters. Said Lincoln, "He will not tell me either." The final Union campaign of the Civil War began on May 3, 1864. After 2 days of marching, the Army of the Potomac reached the Wilderness. It was a thickly wooded area west of Fredericksburg, Virginia. That was where the Union Army had lost a battle to the Confederates 1 year before. That was where the two armies would fight again.
The battle quickly became a blind struggle. The woods were thick. The smoke was heavy. The soldiers could not see each other until they were very close. Shells set the trees on fire. The wounded could not escape the flames. Their screams filled the air. After 2 days, General Grant decided that the Wilderness was not the place to fight Robert E. Lee. He wanted to get around the end of Lee's army. He wanted to fight in the open, where he could use his artillery. So he began to march his men toward a place called Spotsylvania Courthouse.
Lee moved his men as fast as Grant. When the Union Army got to Spotsylvania, the Confederates were waiting behind walls of earth and stone. For several more days, the two armies fought. At times, they were so close they had no time to load and fire their guns. So, they used their guns to hit each other. The Confederate line bent, but it never broke. Once again, Lee had stopped the Union Army. Grant refused to accept defeat. He said he would fight to the finish, if it took all summer. Once again, he ordered his men to march around the end of Lee's line. Lee quickly pulled his men back to a place called Cold Harbor, not far from Richmond. There they waited.
As he had done in the Wilderness and at Spotsylvania, Grant ordered his men to attack hard. It was a slaughter. In less than an hour, 7,000 Union soldiers fell dead or wounded. Grant finally stopped the attack. The Union soldiers returned to their lines. They left behind hundreds of wounded men. For 4 days, the wounded lay on the battlefield crying for help, for water. Men who tried to rescue them were shot down. Finally, Grant and Lee agreed on a ceasefire to take care of the wounded and bury the dead. It was too late for most of the wounded. They had died.
The battle at Cold Harbor ended 1 month of fighting for the Army of the Potomac. The campaign had brought it almost to the edge of Richmond, the Confederate capital. But Grant had paid a terrible price. More than 50,000 dead and wounded. Confederate losses were much lighter, about 20,000. General Grant was beginning to learn an important lesson of the war. The methods of defense had improved much more than the methods of attack.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.